Good morning. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. We are in the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. My partner in crime, Patrick, is on the road this week counting turkeys out in Kansas City, but he'll be back next week. We are sponsored for today's show and for all the shows this week by Cabot Cheese, an absolutely amazingly generous and fantastic offering from Cabot. And please remember that for holiday recipes, let the great taste of Cabot Cheese make them even more special. Award-winning Cabot Cheese, 100% of our profits go to New England and New York farm families, and they can be found on the web at cabotcheese.com. And of course, you can find Cabot Cheese in every grocery store across the country. And I must say that for a mass-produced cheese, it's a really great product. I love it myself. So our guests today are from the New School and from Parsons. We have Radhika Subramaniam, who is the director of the and curator for the Sheila Johnson galleries at Parsons School. And our other guest who will be joining us in a few moments is Nevin Cohen, who is the director of environmental studies at the New School. And they have collaborated on a fantastic exhibit, which can be seen right now at the Sheila Johnson Design Center, 13th Street and Fifth Avenue, which is called Living Concrete, Carrot City. And this is an exhibition that is touring around the United States and Canada, too, right, Radhika? Mm-hmm. And it is a collaboration between the two disciplines. It has a very interesting kind of sociological component that is separate from the design component. So we'll bring Nevin in a few minutes to talk about that, sort of the food systems and the sociological element. And let's talk a little bit with Radhika about the design and sort of how you guys came together to put this exhibition together, which involves both models, a lot of photography, some topographical sort of blueprint type work, and then a lot of computer interface interaction type of additions to the exhibition. So when this opened up a couple months ago, actually, right?
October 1st.
And it's running until December 14th, 15th?
Yes.
Yeah. It's definitely worth taking a look at. I liked the exhibit a lot. It was, I took a look at it the other day, so I wouldn't be completely embarrassed during this interview. But you can see a lot of the components online as well, right?
Yes, you can.
What's the website?
newschool.edu/sjdc.
Mm-hmm. And that shows, that will take you right to the exhibition, and you can see these various short films with different people. And the show, as you might imagine, from Concrete Living / Carrot City, is largely based on the idea of bringing food systems into communities and allowing design to kind of connect with food, not in the locavore way, as we were discussing earlier, but in a way that just connects people to their food and how they get food and what they're eating. So let's talk a little bit about how you guys came up with some of these design concepts, because you show quite a few different designs, including our very own Brooklyn Grange, which was partly built by the Roberta staff. And then there are several other, there's Added Value Farms. We've had Ian Marvey on here a couple of times to talk about food systems and some other people who are, and there, what was the other big New York City? It was the,
Eagle
Street Rooftop, yeah.
We have a bee cam from Eagle Street Rooftop Farms beaming their bees into our space.
Oh, how fabulous. That's right, because you have several hives up on that one.
Yes.
Yeah. And I actually saw in the exhibition there are some models or prototypes for new types of hives that would be specific to, I guess, urban design or urban agriculture.
Yeah. Which is
and where did that come from?
From Omelette. Omelette is a company out of the UK.
Uh-huh.
So that component is actually part of the Carrot City. So Carrot City is a traveling visiting show. Comes from Canada, Ryerson. And one of the curators of that show, Joe Nasser, was at the New School this spring as a Mellon Fellow. So the genesis of the project was really that Nevin Cohen, Nevin is the chair at Environmental Studies, brought the Carrot City project to me last year and said, you know, Would you be interested in housing this traveling show, which is really looking at design and food production, the sort of interchange between how can design facilitate food production, how can food production, how does it affect urban design? And talking with Nevin, I realized that across the New School, there's an enormous amount of interest and research and studio work being done in the area of food systems from an environmental perspective, social perspective, food studies, architecture, and so on. And so I said, if you're interested in doing a much larger initiative, I'm game. Partly because the mission of the Sheila Johnson Design Center is really to blur the boundaries between the classroom and the studio and the exhibition spaces. So we want something that's a little bit more porous. It also seemed important to think, what's the role of a very urban university like the New School in this debate at this point in time? You know, it's not a land-grant institution. It's not a, you know, it's not a university that has a campus.
Right. New York is really your campus.
Yeah, New York is your campus. So what does that mean? And so we started, in a sense, inventorying lots of projects across the New School that dealt in a variety of different ways, from architecture's design build mm-hmm. to a much more service design approach to urban design to Nevin's own planning classes to sort of put together what we call the living concrete component to Carrot City that really tried to connect food systems, design in a variety of ways, not just products, mm-hmm. And I'll use a shorthand, communities, people.
Right,
and how they sort of live and how they link to this work.
What did you mean by service design? I don't understand that term.
Okay, design has now expanded a little bit beyond just the notion of products and prototypes. So people are now looking at design in a much broader arena of design thinking, ways of thinking that might contribute to the design of places, design of spaces. Service design is a way of interfacing with a client to enable them to design sort of infrastructures, if you will, not built infrastructures, but infrastructures of ways you work, ways things are set up.
Very abstract, Radhika.
Well, no. Let me say, okay, let me give
for
you a
very concrete, literal thinker like me, okay.
So the project that's there, which is a student initiative out of a cooperative design or a participatory design course, it was called Cooperative. Students were asked to work with some bodegas on the Lower East Side mm-hmm. to come up with new designs depending on the sort of problem posed by the bodega owner or as they saw in terms of observation. And this might have to do with how they displayed spaces, how people could come in and move around. Mm-hmm. So there were a variety of different, problems to which the students respond in terms
sure.
of design. The things that we showcase, two of them are simple, in a sense, design solutions to problems that the students see and the problems of sort of interviewing and setting up a kind of design prototype for the bodega owner. One of them, though, is much more reflective about what does it mean for a designer to work together with someone else. So it's not a traditional designer-client approach. It's also trying to get young designers to realize that they can't simply parachute into a location and provide a solution. They actually are in a conversation with people who are experts.
Uh-huh. Fascinating. I mean, I'm taking that in right now. But so, in other words, it's creating more of a dialogue between the designer and the consumer of that design, where the consumer of the design is informing the designer about the project in a way that I don't think is standard or typical in
yes.
the current design.
And certainly
models.
Not for, I mean, for us in terms of training young designers, you want them to remember that, right? And
yeah, that they are actually being hired. They're not really God.
Yes, indeed.
You know, they're not going to render decisions from on high with no input, which I think has been a real problem with architecture in general in the last 50 or 60 years. But that's for another show to discuss. There's a great architecture show on the network that would definitely like to dig into that one. But let's take like 2 seconds and we're going to come back with Nevin Cohen. And then we will continue to talk about sort of, you know, your part of this project and his.
Thank you.
This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're discussing a project at the New School right now at the Sheila Johnson Design Center, which is called Concrete Living Carrot City. And my guests today are Radhika Subramaniam, and we're about to hook up with Nevin Cohen, who is the chair of the Environmental Studies Program, right, Radhika? Mm-hmm. And you are the director of the Sheila Johnson Gallery and the curator of that?
Yes, I am.
And what's your other title there? Did I miss something? Or
no, director and curator. I also teach.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So we were just having a little conversation about the different model of that design students are adopting under this very project. And you said in the break there that the students themselves were the ones who came up with the idea that they needed to actually have a dialogue with the consumer of their design. So let's just tease that thread out for a second while we're waiting for you. Got Jack? Have you got him on the phone, Jack? Okay, cool. Nevin, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, beauty. Okay,
I'm
great.
I'm sorry I couldn't be here in person, but I'm glad.
I know. Me too. Well, it's okay. I'll be seeing you in the flesh. I think on Thursday, right?
Wednesday.
Because the New School has been putting up a series of panels, and we should just mention those in passing. As long as we're on the topic, we've had some wonderful speakers in your panels, and you're having them every night for the next week.
No, we have almost them every night? Wednesday for the duration of the show. So there will be 10 of them eventually. Uh-huh. I think we're at 7 or 8 with you.
7 or 8, yeah. And they will go until the end of the show, which is December 15th.
That's right.
Yeah. And Nevin,
And this week actually focuses on media advocacy and dialogue, which will be, I think, of interest to Heritage Radio listeners.
I certainly hope so, since I'm on the panel. I'll be blibbity blabbing away. Yes, I'm such a show off. I love these kind of opportunities. So, Nevin, let's we had a little chat with Radhika about sort of the design component of this, and of course we'll go back to that. But let's hear a little bit about your part of this being the chair of environmental studies at the New School.
We were actually funded by the Mellon Foundation to infuse systems thinking using the food system into our environmental studies program. And so for the past couple of years, we've been introducing courses that teach students how to think about systems in the city by looking at the food system. So I teach a food systems course, and I also teach an urban planning course that focuses quite a lot on urban food issues. And so as part of the Living Concrete part of the exhibition, we have a number of different projects that New School students who have been exploring the intersection of planning, systems thinking, and food have put together.
Well, the things that I saw, I did actually go to the exhibition. You'll be happy to know I didn't come into this completely blind. And it did showcase like some of the projects that I was already familiar with. Of course, the Brooklyn Grange, because that's a Roberta's thing, and of course I was well familiar with Ian Marvey's project at Added Value and what they've been doing there. And then the Eagle Street Rooftop Farm, which I was not familiar with but learned about during the show. So those are some of the sort of intersections between concrete living and carrots. Right.
The focus is really on everyday urban agriculture. Mm-hmm. The idea that people in communities have been for the last 100 years actually growing food in their own communities, and particularly in the last 30 to 40 years, community gardening has been a really vibrant part of many New York City neighborhoods. So the show from its point of view, really focuses on the kinds of interventions that people can make in their neighborhoods using often very very simple materials. We don't feature very many of the what I would consider dystopian architectural projects that seem to envision a future of food growing that requires enormous amounts of capital and
specialized expertise. You mean like vertical farming?
Like vertical farming, like the Pig City project, for example, which imagines pigs being raised on the 32nd story of a skyscraper. Those kinds of projects, I don't think make sense. And really, what the show is about is the opportunity for agriculture to create vibrant civic communities in which people farm together, explore the food system together, and actually take charge of their neighborhoods.
So this is not about actually solving any kind of food delivery problem or creating a place where people can expect to grow enough food to serve the needs of their community. It's really about building community in the sense of bringing people together in a project that is, you know, pleasurable, that gives some reward, but which is not really, it's not really about solving agricultural issues, right?
It's about solutions to agricultural issues, which do include food production in the city. So one of the projects is a project in collaboration with the Design Trust for Public Space called Five Borough Farms.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a fellow with the Design Trust on this project, and I'm working together with a colleague.
How many acres is that?
The Five Borough Farms covers the entire five boroughs.
It's a virtual. Okay, sorry.
The goal of the project is to create the first ever urban agriculture plan for New York City,
mm-hmm.
to explore what can be produced and what's reasonable to be produced in the city, and the kinds of policies and programs that can be put in place to foster urban agriculture. But my colleague is also working on metrics to measure the impact of urban agriculture, because, as we all know, urban farming, urban agriculture, is not just about the food production, it's about the social and economic benefits that agriculture brings to neighborhoods.
Right. Well, that's what I'm thinking about, because I don't see it as any solution to food production, because even if you used virtually every rooftop in the city, you still would not be able to provide school lunch for the entire five boroughs of school children, for example. I mean, realistically, right? I mean, even, for instance, we've had Gotham Greens, the garden. Jen Nelken has come on a couple of times to talk about, and that's a big rooftop, hydroponic rooftop garden. And they're anticipating growing something like 50,000 pounds of vegetables a year when they really get up and running. And I'm thinking to myself, 50,000 pounds of vegetables a year is a drop in the bucket here. And so even if you have, 100 projects that grow 50,000 pounds of vegetables a year, I mean, do you guys have numbers on how many actual, you know, how much actual produce you'll be able to produce within a certain, you know, framework? Do you I'm trying to get a handle on sort of like how much this is going to bring into the community, and how much of it is really about building community and building connections between people and sort of bringing more attention to how people get their food as opposed to actually feeding them.
We can actually produce quite a lot if we can reimagine urban agriculture. So we had Stacey Murphy on a panel last week talking about BK Farmyards,
yes.
which is her project to weave together backyard farms into sizable enough parcels of land to farm productively. And there are 50,000 or so acres of yard space in New York City. And if we can find ways to weave those yards together and create businesses to farm them, we could produce enough vegetables to feed about 700,000 New Yorkers.
Interesting.
And so that's where service design, I know you were discussing service design with Radhika before, that's where service design really comes into play, and it's understanding the need to sort of rethink a system like agriculture and designing services to actually make it feasible. So mm-hmm. that might mean gardening services, services to provide the raw materials for backyard farmers, and then some kind of service to actually distribute the produce efficiently.
Well, I was just going to say, because when we talk to most of the guests that come on this show, it's we always arrive at that particular problem, which is processing facilities and distribution systems, which simply do not exist on a regional level. And so you're talking about an infrastructure that is, you know, still in everyone's imagination in terms of connecting all these urban farms. And that, to me, is the hardest part of the puzzle to solve, both in terms of creating a system within the city and also connecting that system to farmers who are outside of New York City and you know, upstate or in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, or whatever.
Absolutely, because even if we wove together all the backyards, we couldn't produce all the food we need to eat. And so the distribution system, you hit it on the head, is really the key problem to solve.
Well, last week we had Matt Weingarten on from Sodexo. He runs the restaurant at St. Bart's. And he gave a shout out. I mean, he was like, if there are any entrepreneurs out there listening, you know, this is the business to get into. And it's something that we've, you know, we've tried to get people interested in over and over again. It's like, how do you, you know, it's like everybody wants to do the right thing. Everyone wants to grow their stuff. They want to do, you know, but without somebody to process it, in other words, and that means like not just harvesting it, but it's cleaning the vegetables, packing the vegetables, making sure that they're, you know, ready to go to whatever place they need to go to in condition that is usable. And then have a trucking system that moves them to the places that they need to go. And in a way, I feel like that's, if that piece of the puzzle hasn't been addressed or solved, then the rest of it is really kind of just, you know, a happy story. Do you guys, have you guys, I mean, I have to confess to you, I didn't see that in your exhibition. I didn't see that part of the puzzle. That's why I'm kind of dwelling on it.
It's obnoxiously. It's in there. For example, well, it's in there in a couple of places. I'll just mention two. One is a field guide to the Lower East Side that my students developed last year in a planning class.
And that was the map with all the little. Right. Yeah, I saw that. That was cool.
A map and also a field guide you could actually put in your backpack and walk around the neighborhood with. And that includes,
downloadable off the website.
Processing facility, and it's downloadable. Yes, as a PDF. Processing facilities and distribution facilities on the Lower East Side. So we were trying to identify and explain that part of the food system, which is so critical. And then there's an example from the Carrot City part of the exhibition. It's the Stop Center in Toronto, which our colleagues from Toronto also presented in one of our panels. And the Stop Center is a multifunctional urban agriculture center. So there's food growing there, but there's also a commercial kitchen and processing facilities and a farmer's market for distribution. And so communities throughout the country and in cities around the world are beginning to think of creating food hubs that would serve those many, many needs.
I'm sorry, what did you call that? A food hug?
Hub.
Food hub.
Sorry.
A physical place.
We are trying to create a food hug. Yes.
Yeah, that's just so earthy crunchy. I can't say no. A food hub, that makes sense. Well, I think that, you know, when I love this idea. I love that everybody is wanting to do this. And one of the questions that came to my mind when Radhika and I were talking earlier was the fact that she said that this, that you're using the food system as kind of a metaphor for so many other things, and that there are so many kids who are interested in the food system and how it plays out in these different disciplines, whether it's urban design or urban planning, architecture, etc. And I wanted to just talk a little bit about that sort of trend in young people just for a second, since, you know, that's kind of what you guys are, you're all about shaping those young minds. What over the last 10 years, have you seen like a tremendous increase in, you know, what students want to do with their time and what they're thinking about? Or are you the ones who are really pushing this agenda? Or
I don't think so. I think the students are actually interested. Nevin may be able to speak much more directly to this. I can talk a little bit about how we shaped it in the gallery. But in terms of a trend, you might be able to say more about that, Nevin.
Do you want to go first, Radhika?
No, go for it.
No, you are. You are. You've been tapped.
Okay, great. I can only say anecdotally that the interest has skyrocketed among my students. Typical students at the New School, there aren't really any typical students, but yeah. Students for the most part are interested in writing and literature and the traditional liberal arts. And now, in addition to that, many of them want to learn how to grow food, and it's become a real passion. And so a number of the projects in the exhibition are projects that our students have done through internships, measuring the amount of produce being grown in community gardens around the city. One of my students was working at Brooklyn Grange mm-hmm. all summer as a farmer. I've had students up at Stone Barns learning how to farm. So it's really unusual that students who are deliberately coming to an urban liberal arts college are also really excited by learning how to produce food.
I know. I find it fascinating, I have to say. I mean, I am so amazed at this incredible amount of energy. Now, mind you, it's very much, I think, urban centric and very much about the East and the West Coast. And there isn't a lot of this interest going on, I think, in other parts of the country. But still, you know, things will grow towards the center eventually. And certainly one of our goals here.
I had a student working on a farm in Flint, Michigan, actually, a couple of summers ago. So I think it's, and students are using WOOF, Worldwide Organic Farming, to find internships in other countries as well.
Wow.
Although the school is an East Coast liberal arts college, I think that the trend is actually happening throughout the country.
Really? I mean, I went out to Colorado a couple of weeks ago, and I actually was on a chef tour for certified Angus beef. And the chefs that were on this tour were by no means connected to this movement at all. Not at all. And they were young guys. It was really interesting. It was like, because they were all from Texas, Colorado, you know, the Midwestern states where agriculture is, you know, has become these monolithic, you know, companies, and the small independent farm type of thing is kind of gone by the wayside. And I guess even if they'd grown up in a rural area, they weren't really connecting to that. They were very, very much focused on sort of status quo, and, you know, and that's why they wanted to be on this tour. So it was really, I really did get the sense that it wasn't something that was nationwide. So it's nice to hear that you're seeing students from all over the country who are coming into the new school or who are going out into the world, into the rest of the United States, and bringing this message with them.
But it's also interesting because
we have Dan Patera from the University of Detroit Mercy coming to speak on one of our panels. Mm-hmm. And he's been working with students, architecture students, and community residents to come up with a 2,000-acre food system for a neighborhood that's got many acres of vacant land that would actually help train drug addicted residents who are part of a special nonprofit program in how to farm and then process food and sell it. And so I think while the overall idea that food is certainly trendy on the coasts in certain cities, there are really a lot of very exciting projects going on throughout the country.
Well, I love this green collar job thing that's growing. That I think is really sensational, because I think that it's a value to so many people who otherwise, you know, don't really have a direction or really want to know where they're going, and don't really want to, you know, necessarily work in a service job or something like that, where farming can really offer something much more satisfying to them.
I want to pull out one of the projects that we have there, which comes at it from a very different place. You know, there's a media studies professor, a sound artist, who did a sound installation called Sprawl. Sprawl meaning population sprawl, but she was really working with colony collapse disorder and the relationship of human communication to sort of the bee life, if you will. And it uses field recordings of bees as well as various human interventions, from hand crank sirens to a cell phone chorus that a group of students did, you know, bzz, bzz, bzz of the cell phone. And it's you know, it's created in the form of a sound installation, which actually was performed in the gallery last week. But I guess I want to register that the other disciplines that may not seem traditionally orientated towards getting one's hands dirty, which is, you know, music, sound, writing, you know, other, also have actually very profound awareness of environmental issues, and perhaps link to people in a very fundamental way. So they, not all of us want to be farmers,
no.
You know, and not all of us want to grow food but we all know something about eating, and we all have feelings about how we live in the world. And, you know, there are ways to sort of enter and tweak that connection, which I also hope is part of what the exhibition makes possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that one thing that's always that has astonished me also in the last 5 or 10 years is the growth of people who want to write about food and work in this sort of context. And that sort of speaks to what you're talking about. And it's not just, you know, writing your food, your memoir and studying it with recipes or, you know, writing another cookbook or something like that. But it's really, you know, that your relationship to food is something that defines in large measure the how you live the rest of your life as well. And and I think that exhibition, your exhibition, actually brings up some of that, because it is, it does show that being connected to the way food is produced and having these urban structures become not just concrete monoliths, but be green spaces as well, I think is something that is going to benefit urban life and people who live in cities, you know, as it grows. I think it's going to really have a profound effect on how we perceive cities and whether it makes them more attractive. I'm assuming it will, but I mean, it's, there's something very, very profoundly different about this way of seeing urban life. I think, I guess that's the point I'm trying to make, is that bringing farming and bringing agriculture and bringing these kind of sort of traditional values into an urban context is a very, very different way of looking at cities and city living. And I guess that's the triumph of your exhibition, I suppose, is that you're able to really make that point. That there
what is
it's that.
Just connecting people. I mean, people know about food. They've been eating it for a long time.
Yeah.
So, it in a sense is not making happy families. I mean, at least I hope. But it is reminding someone that you actually know quite a bit about something that you have become disengaged from. And that appears to be the burst of interest, I think, in this area of work.
That we did, I mean, looking at food from a historic perspective, my contention is that when we allowed, I guess maybe during World War II, when we really allowed companies like Swanson's and, Le Sueur canned peas, when we allowed food processing to take over the kitchen and people stopped spending time in the kitchen and stopped learning how to cook, that was the beginning of losing control over our food system. And now, everybody's all mad that, they don't have control over what's going into these products. But the fact is, we just, kind of let go of the reins there. And suddenly everybody wants to take up that control again. And I think that is one of the more profound, sociological changes that I've seen in my lifetime, certainly.
And because those things were also threaded with, issues about where women, what women's place were, who was, who was the butcher, who was the cook, who was, who served the. So a lot of those things have to be re-envisioned and repossessed, if you will.
Do you think that people are going to be willing to pay more for their food? I mean, food actually really costs a lot more than what we pay for it. And the reason that we don't see those costs is because a lot of food production is subsidized by the government. I mean, basic core ingredients are subsidized. And when you subsidize things like feed for livestock or grains that go into your cereal, then you as a taxpayer actually are paying for that food, but you're not seeing that cost. And you're certainly not seeing the environmental costs, right, Nevin?
Well, that's the key. When people begin to understand the full life cycle costs of conventional food, and when people also have an opportunity to actually participate in food production, then I think the decision-making really, really changes. And, of course, very low-income residents can't afford to pay more for food, but there are opportunities, and that's part of the exhibition's goal, is to think through what are the opportunities to make sustainable food actually the most sensible choice, because it's also the most cost-effective and efficient choice. And we have one project in the exhibition, a farm that Dennis Derrick, a professor at the New School, created on his own to serve as a CSA farm for the South Bronx, for the Hunts Point neighborhood, mm-hmm. one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. And through creative design of the project and creative pricing, he's been able to supply really wonderful food from farmers throughout Schoharie County to Hunts Point, and at a price that the residents can afford. So I think it's a false sort of choice between affordability and quality food.
Because it's like a health issue.
Rethink and redesign the system.
Yeah, I think, I mean, let's we're going to take a quick break here and come back in just a minute. But let's drill down on that particular issue, because I think that, you know, that's one of the biggest things that comes up in the sort of alternative food movement is the cost and value for residents. We'll be right back. He worked and raised family with grandma by his side. And when the week was ended and all the work was over, the folks down in Holler, they'd come from far and wide. Come on down, don't fuss and squalor. Come on down to Marsh's place, they're dancing in the holler. Come on down, there's folks that you can follow. This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We are located in the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Our program today and for the next 2 weeks will be sponsored by Cabot Cheese. God bless them. They've made a very, very generous commitment to us to support all of our programming over the next 2 weeks, and we are mighty grateful. Our guests today are Radhika Subramaniam. Oh, I have a special thing to read to you. Oh, I'm so excited. Oh, we have a contest. Thanks, Jack. The New England and New York farm families who own Cabot Cooperative, and that's, I didn't realize they were a cooperative, but now I know, are offering listeners a chance. So listen up, listeners. They are offering listeners a chance to win some of the world's best cheddar cheese simply by calling in. Where's the number, Jack?
718-497-2128.
Or emailing me, meaning the writer of this, at program email address.
info@heritageradionetwork.com.
Thank you, Jack. What a great way to start the holidays. I'll be picking the winner for my program by, well, 2 weeks from today, which I think is today is November 14th. And Cabot Creamery is a proud supporter of what Heritage Radio Network is all about. So let's repeat that number one more time.
718-497-2128.
And you can, or you can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.com for a chance to participate in this opportunity to win some of the world's best cheddar. And it is some of the world's best cheddar. I love Cabot cheddar cheese. I buy it almost every week. So anyway, our guests today are Radhika Subramaniam from the Parsons School. You are the director and curator of the Sheila Johnson Design Facility. And Nevin Cohen is coming to us via telephone from Florida. Nevin is the chair of the Environmental Studies Program at the New School. And we're discussing their current co-exhibition, which is called Concrete Living Carrot City. And we were just about to drill down into the economics of changing the urban food landscape. So let's talk a little bit more about, since you're an environmental studies professor, Nevin, let's talk a little bit about how conventional food really costs and how you see being able to win the hearts and minds of New York residents into participating in a better food system, even if on the surface it looks like it's costing a few pennies more a pound.
Okay, that's a tall order, but I'll try to start.
Yeah, never let it be said that I let you rest on your laurels, buddy.
The conventional food system has lots of costs that we don't see at the supermarket checkout counter.
That's
and
right.
Those are environmental costs. The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is dead because of nutrients running off into the Mississippi River downstream and causing algal blooms in the Gulf. So that's a huge environmental cost with concrete financial costs to communities that is the direct result of decisions made to support conventional commodity crop growing in the Midwest.
And yet we love commodity crop growing because it provides us with so many wonderful foods at such a cheap price. So why should people, I mean, I'm just going to play the devil's advocate here. Of course, I'm obviously, you know, in the right camp. But I mean, why should anybody care that there's a big algae bloom in the Gulf of Mexico or to the Chesapeake Bay for that matter. I mean, okay, those fishing communities are screwed, but so what?
But that's just one example. So there, you know, there's pesticide contamination in groundwater that communities then have to pay money to remediate. There's contamination of bacteria in communities that in community drinking water in communities surrounding confined animal feeding operations. And so we don't have enough time in this show to go over this, but the each individual cost is substantial, both long-term to future generations who might also care about the health of the Gulf waters and the seafood industry there, but also direct costs that are even short-term to communities that have to spend money on health costs and remediation costs to clean up the pollution that is making our food so cheap at the supermarket counter, but actually not so cheap overall to our society.
So how
we have to spend the money anyway. The question then is, how do we make sure that people have enough money to eat healthy food and have enough to eat?
To eat alternative foods. And how do you persuade them that those costs are really there, they're just not seeing them? How do you convey that message?
Lots of different programs. So the health department in New York and in cities around the country offer health bucks to people who are on food stamps and WIC.
So they can participate in farmers markets, right?
Exactly. That's one small example. But if we think about the infrastructure that we can begin to invest in to make farming around the metropolitan area and in other communities around the country more efficient and profitable, they include things like a wholesale farmers market in the city. So farmers from the region don't have to drive every day to the green market and sell, but can store their food and sell it to supermarkets and restaurants more efficiently. Processing facilities for livestock in the region that will enable farmers to make a bigger profit or sell at a lower cost to consumers because they don't have to ship their animals to Philadelphia to be processed and then back to the New York City market. So we need to think about the infrastructure that can make a sustainable food system actually cost less than the conventional system that we've been relying on.
And
I believe it's possible, and there are lots of projects that demonstrate that you can actually really drive down the cost of food produced sustainably close to the consumer if you are willing to invest in the infrastructure to make that possible.
So how do we find people who are willing? I mean, the state is bankrupt. So New York State, for example, is not going to be able to be a partner in this. I mean, just for the short term anyway. Maybe Governor Cuomo will change things around, but somehow I doubt it. What can we expect in terms of state aid or federal aid in creating regional networks that support this kind of effort? I mean, how do you change policy at the governmental level? Because essentially, that's what you're talking about.
It's shifting the subsidies from conventional agriculture to smaller scale agriculture. Mm. And that's beginning to happen at USDA under this administration.
Really?
So the traditional corn, soybean, livestock lobbies still hold sway in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
But there's a new farm bill up for reauthorization in 2012, and people can get involved with organizations trying to change policy in the farm bill. And then there are entrepreneurial efforts like the one I mentioned just previously, Dennis Derrick and his new type of community-supported agriculture project. There are cities that are investing money in food hubs to HUB create opportunities for sustainable food at the local level. So I think people just have to get involved at each level, from working with groups to do direct lobbying to actually creating innovative projects that can then be replicated and scaled up.
We were talking earlier about systems design, and I feel like this comes under the heading of systems design, because we're talking about reimagining a whole supply chain and changing government policy in order to support those changes. And I think it's, you know, fantastic that your exhibition both addresses that, but also that on another level that your students are so interested in changing that system design from what exists now, which is really such a strange hodgepodge of arcane rules and things left over from the early 1900s. And for instance, in the meat industry, there's a lot of, you know, back and forth about the GIPSA rule, the Grain Inspection and Stockyards Act. I mean, it's got everybody in a complete twizzle in the meat industry. And I actually don't even know which side is the right side, to tell you the truth. But I think that there's a lot of ambiguities in many of the agricultural sectors that need to be addressed by a system design approach. And I wondered sort of where, you know, where your exhibition, you know, can sort of lend support to that idea, and how you can persuade your students to think in that those sort of global terms.
Well, certainly what we try to teach in our courses, and it's heartening to me that at least the these issues are actually being debated and discussed. Our panel discussions are standing room only every week. There's an enormous amount of interest from the community as well as students and faculty. So that gives me a little bit of hope that actually we can begin to accomplish some of the changes that need to happen.
And also, what, some of the things we've been trying to do in the exhibition itself is making things transparent and visible to the individual, so that and anyone coming in, student or member of the public, can see their connection to the system. Because often when you speak about systems, just like you speak about food, it becomes divorced from yourself. And the minute it is up in the ether as a system floating about above you, you don't know how to enter it. So we've tried a lot of little strategies, including ask us any question you want about urban agriculture and we'll answer it.
Yeah, I read that with great... I was going to bring that up because the biggest question that was repeated over and over again on that wall was about composting, which I thought was fascinating.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the most fascinating discoveries in the course of our public programs, Nevin actually moderated a discussion on the politics of urban agriculture, which I had anticipated would have a lot of other kinds of things, you know, about food deserts and, you know, areas of the city that are not served and so on. But no, soil has been the sort of sustained thread, if you will, throughout a lot of discussions. And in a way, that's where the politics have lain, you know. That's the sort of been the rub, the earth, where all discussions have sort of devolved again and again.
Because the soil in New York is so polluted, you mean?
Well, or people have concerns, yes. How do you get soil? How do you grow soil?
Yeah.
That's the bit that, you know, as people have said, closes the loop on it.
New York landscape is so toxic. I mean, because it's absorbed so much punishment over the last 150 years or whatever. Whenever we became industrialized, that's when the soil began to lose its value as a growing medium. So, yeah, I thought it was great that so many people were like, well, how would I compost this? And are there big... And that's a system. There's a system right there that hasn't happened yet. But, I mean, we have recycling, but we don't have composting.
No, it disappeared two years ago.
How can we create a composting... What do you mean it disappeared 2 years ago?
Sanitation.
There was a law in the books that required the sanitation
Department of sanitation.
I had no idea, and I bet nobody else who's listening to this show knew that either.
Oh, it's a two. But I mean, you have enough kind of interest in this.
I think that is a
possible lobby, right, to return this.
I would think that would be like a number one priority in terms of expanding this whole movement and also saving money for the city. I mean. Although recycling costs more money than it returns. Isn't that true? Isn't that why they abandoned it for a little while?
The city council actually passed a bill over the summer that requires the city to study not only leaf and yard waste composting, but food waste composting. Mm-hmm. So your listeners probably hadn't heard about that because it wasn't well publicized, but we need to focus the sanitation department's effort to make sure that their study is really... well done, so that we can think about a food waste composting system in New York like San Francisco and Seattle and Vancouver have.
Those West Coast people, they're always so cool. I don't know. No, I actually had this, I remember having this conversation about 4 years ago with my piano teacher, who's very concerned. He's a wonderful guy. And he said, I want to start a composting system in my building. And I said, really? I grew up composting because I grew up in the country. I hated composting. It was disgusting. We always had this bucket full of reeking crap on the counter and fruit flies and everything. I mean, it was just revolting. I'm sorry, but it was. And I thought to myself, well, you know, David, do you realize what you're talking? You know, you'd have to have some huge facility down in the basement of your building. But I thought, why not? You get one of those quick composters that's a drum that turns, and, you know, there's always bound to be a few people who want to volunteer for that kind of thing. It's a question of educating the public. And there's another system that has to be put into place before you can even start thinking about getting the sanitation department to come on board with it. Is you have to get the people to be willing to separate out their foods, their trash, even further Absolutely. Than just recycling.
That's definitely systems design. And also my students have just finished mapping different elements of the food system, and one of those elements are composting sites that are open to the public that are in community gardens. So there already are opportunities for people if they want to voluntarily compost their waste, and we've mapped them. But obviously scaling that up requires some really more sophisticated.
Very sophisticated. I mean, because people who live in, you know, Midtown or in, I mean, I live near Riverside Park. Conceivably, you could have a composting facility in Riverside Park. Would I be willing to trot my trash down to Riverside Park every 2 days or 3 days? I doubt it. So really, it's, I mean, even with the best will in the world, I mean, you're going to have to get people in buildings. If I had to go maybe next door, I might do it, but really not.
No, this is part of what you have to think of when you're designing a new system, right? What makes it easy enough to do?
Yeah,
what is the extra step yes. that you won't take?
Right.
I mean, we all take extra steps now to get people are members of, people go to the farmer's market instead of the local grocery store. I mean, there are all sorts of things that people
Some
make
people
adjustments.
Do.
Some people can't. I mean, there isn't yeah. anywhere to go. Yeah,
that's right. And some people are, you know, even have trouble separating their trash. I mean, when you're old, for instance.
I use that example. In the 80s, people said New Yorkers would never recycle. And the whole idea of a recycling system in New York was just crazy. And we've gotten used to it. And mm-hmm. I don't think people think twice about it.
No, I don't think so. It's the same thing with the pooper scooper law. I don't know why that comes into my mind. But when I first moved to New York in 1976... or 77, I guess it was, you know, you really couldn't walk down the street. It was a nasty situation. And within a couple of years, that was over. I mean, that was, talk about a public education. Of course, everybody had a vested interest in participating in that. I'm not sure how easy it would be to tell people that they have a vested interest in recycling their food scraps. I mean, I just, not to be a naysayer here, but I'm just thinking like,
no, but
how
I
do you
think
educate
this...
the public? How do you make people invest in something like this personally to the point where they will actually, you know, separate out their stuff and trot their trash wherever it needs to go? Or, you know, it's, I think this is not insurmountable, but a really tall order.
When you come to the media and advocacy panel next week, this will be a point of discussion. You'll change the
yeah,
engine a little bit. Well, all things are public education.
Yeah.
And it's a good challenge. It's a good challenge to think, what are the various strategies one might
Well, I guess I think the question is what kind of incentives do you provide to people to participate? You know, because recycling, it used to be you got 5 cents a bottle and that was an incentive enough for you to retain your bottles and turn them in. You don't have so much that now, but you know, what incentive can you offer people in order to, especially people who are not the people who are listening to this program, not the people who built out Roberta's, not the people who are, you know, your students, but people who are basically, you know, not particularly invested in their food, not particularly well-educated, and don't really care. I mean, still want to go to McDonald's.
It's design, both physical design and policy design. It's making it easy. It's mm-hmm. making it clean and safe, and then it's changing public policy so it's the expected thing to do. And that was exactly what happened in the recycling, the move to recycling in New York, uh-huh. figuring out a system that actually makes it easy and convenient for New Yorkers, and then requiring them to do it, and then changing the expectations. So we have to look at our West Coast friends to find out how they were able to do it.
Yeah, but, I'm wondering. So what did they do? Do you know? What happened in San Francisco that encouraged people to participate in a vast food waste recycling effort?
It's a different city, and so they have a different waste collection system, and it's low density in many neighborhoods. But
yeah.
People were given brown bags to put their food waste in, and brown baskets on the sidewalk, and there was a lot of education. But mm-hmm. eventually, the system seems to work.
And the city was willing to invest the money in that infrastructure. That's what I think is also very interesting, is that they were able to, that the city government itself was willing to buy into this and really make it happen.
But yeah, part of the problem is that not only are individuals disconnected from the food system, but individual agencies are disconnected from the food system. Mm-hmm. And I did a little quick study that 45 different city agencies in New York actually have some role in the food system because they serve meals or they collect waste. And none of them really think of food as being part of their mission. And so part of starting a system like composting is changing the expectations of different agencies, so that the sanitation department needs to think that producing soil for the city mm-hmm. has some economic value, and that right. should be counted as well as simply the cost of trucking it to a composting site and running a composting facility.
Well, it may interest you to know that when I was out on this certified Angus beef tour a couple of weeks ago in Colorado, we were, of course, treated to the gold standard of everyone who participated in this, you know, particular brand. Well, one of the places we went, of course, was a feedlot. And the feedlot, much to Patrick's dismay, I characterize it as being quite benign as opposed to the hellhole that we all like to think of them as. And the thing that really impressed me about it was, and it's a very, very well-run facility, this particular one. It's called the Magnum Feed Yard or something. And what this guy has done is he has a composting plan. So he has actually a third party who comes in and they rake out the waste of these animals every day from the pens, and they have them set up where a truck can come and collect all of this manure and turn it into compost, or, you know, basically turn it into topsoil. Mm-hmm. And, it was just, I thought to myself, well, that's smart, because he's A, making money on this stuff. B, he's dealing with the problem so that his animals are not wallowing in crap. And C, it's environmentally friendly. And, this guy is obviously a more enlightened feedlot owner than probably most of them are. But I think, if it can be demonstrated through some sort of metric that doing this composting, that the city is going to make money on it, that residents are going to benefit from it, that seems to me the big challenge. And then once you get that buy-in from the city government, then you can really force this down everybody's throat, whether they want to or not.
We managed with smoking, right?
Yeah, well, it did. And they crammed that one down everybody's throat. I still miss a good smoky bar, though, I got to tell you. I mean, not that I love to smoke, but a bar doesn't look right without that blue haze. But I will say the city is going to look a lot better without food trash,
Indeed.
So what else? Let's recap just quickly, because we only have a couple more minutes here. First of all, the exhibition is at the Sheila
C. Johnson
Design Center, and that's located on 13th Street. The entrance is on 13th, right off of Fifth Avenue, and the exhibition will run until December 15th.
That's right.
Tell us about some of the panels that are coming up on the next few Wednesdays.
We have a media advocacy and dialogue panel. We've got what is the role of the university in urban agriculture panel coming up. And I'm missing one. Nevin, help me.
Oh, the innovations from other cities.
Oh, yes, that's right.
People from Seattle, from Chicago, and from Detroit.
I should mention that one of the great things about your exhibition, actually, is that you do bring in projects from other cities to show how those cities are starting to create these pilot programs. And that was easily one of the most interesting parts of the whole exhibition, was to see these other design solutions. I thought that was great. You guys did a great job of putting that together.
And those have
the panels are on Wednesday evening from 6:30 to 8:30.
Okay.
We have a little wine. It's very friendly, and nobody leaves before 10.
Okay.
Of their own accord.
Well, no, of their own. Yes, not because we force them. Yeah, the panels end, and then nobody stays. Everyone stays talking, and
that's great.
Yeah,
fantastic. Very exciting. Well, I want to thank you both for being on the show, Nevin. I know it was a little bit of a stretch for you since you had to travel unexpectedly, but thanks so much. Nevin Cohen is the chair of environmental studies at the New School, and our guest in studio, Radhika Subramaniam, is the curator and director of the Sheila C. Johnson Design Center. Thank you both very much.
Thanks,
it's been a
so
wonderful
much.
Show. I really appreciate
thank you.
Thank
Katie.
You. Thanks
you
very
betcha.
Much, Katie.
See you on Wednesday. No,
yes,
next
see
Wednesday.
You on Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
I went across to Switzerland where all the yodelers be, to try to learn the yodel with the yodel.
I climbed a big high mountain on a clear and sunny day and met a yodel and got up in that little sweet chalet. Oh, he taught me to yodel.
And this is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are sponsored today by Cabot Cheese. We love them. And we have my partner in crime, Patrick Martins, is on the phone. Patrick, how's Kansas City treating you?
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I do miss you in the seat there. And this
How's the show been so far?
Well, it was, you know, it was a real brain drain for me, I got to tell you. These people were way too smart for me.
Well, that...
I really could have used your help on this one.
What were they talking about?
Well, we were talking about this wonderful exhibition at the Sheila C. Johnson Design Center on 13th Street, which is part of the New School. And our guests were Nevin Cohen, who's the chair of the Environmental Studies Program at the New School.
Of course.
And Radhika Subramanian, who is the curator and director of the design facility. So... It was all about their exhibition, Living Concrete / Carrot City, which is kind of a bringing together of new approaches towards urban agriculture brought to bear upon this Carrot City exhibition that's been traveling around the country that emanates from Toronto, actually.
Wow. Well, that gets me right on there, you know, about grassroots movements like that, because we just did all the turkeys.
Did you?
Literally every last pound of turkeys. Ooh. Like... We had trucks everywhere. I mean, 18-wheeler trucks coming in, coming out, dropping off, picking up. I mean, it was. We really gave the old forklift a workout. And, you know, it confirmed one thing. If I, Patrick Martins, can do this, and it's not done yet, of course, but, you know, can get the turkeys, redistribute them, so could a lot of these big companies. I mean, they say, oh, well, before we can change, you know, a segment of our business and do something like that, it would take decades. Really? It just takes a team of two or three people.
And a commitment.
And a commitment. You know what I mean? And then there's all this talk also, you know, about school lunches. People are like, oh, we got to send school lunch. You know, whereas they're winnable, fightable battles right now with corporate cafeterias and university chefs. You know, I'm really proud to say... Heritage this year has sold both to Emory University and to Virginia Tech. So,
two big
you know,
colleges,
we're proving that, you know, there can be success stories. And I think it's about time for some of the other, you know, bigger companies to start playing ball and dedicating a couple of percentage of their business to projects like, you know, the one we undertake
every
Thanksgiving.
To supporting small and independent farms, small, medium, and independent farms. Absolutely.
Exactly, Katie. And I'm happy you mentioned the word farm because, you know, why do I really do this and why do I think it's important that other people actually be activists and actually do something rather than just pretend or, you know, say that they enjoy doing things is that we have to basically promote animals living outside.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, we can't keep animals in boxes. You know, like with turkeys, if their instinct is to roost, to wrap their talons around something and fall asleep, they should be allowed to roost. And,
yes.
You know, I believe a happy animal is one that is allowed to fulfill its God-given instincts. And walking is a natural instinct.
Walking, foraging, and pecking.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I got chased
Katie,
by a rooster again.
Before I leave
again.
You for the rest of the show, is there? Have you placed your turkey order yet?
I have not placed my turkey order yet, but I did direct people yesterday to place their orders immediately and also to take a look at our fabulous gift packages for the next holiday, because let's face it, we're in the silly season now, folks. It's all coming at you.
And let me ask, Nat, is yours the order of 20, 18 to 20-pound birds still in effect?
Darn tootin'.
Good, because it's being delivered to your parents' house on Thursday. All right, well, thanks for having me on. Who's coming on after me?
We have a taco truck coming on. I'm excited. I don't know anything about them except that they're a taco truck.
I was honored to be asked on the show. And as far as I'm concerned, we should do a show next week. But we could talk about
that
another time.
Okay, we'll talk about it when you get back. When are you coming back? Are you coming back tonight?
Yeah, I come back tonight, and then, you know, we do all the mail order work for the turkeys, and all the, about, you know, 3,000 turkeys get FedEx to people's homes around the country on Monday the 22nd.
Oh, that is so exciting. Well, I'll be in the trenches with you next weekend doing that. So.
Okay. Well, thanks so much.
Have a safe trip home. Give my best to the Phantasmas.
I'll convey it for sure.
Please. Thanks, Patrick.
Bye.
Okay. So we'll be right back with our friends from the taco truck who are going to tell me everything about themselves during the break. Come on in, folks.
You packed all your things and gave me your ring. Said, honey, I'm leaving for good.
Welcome back to The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. We are sponsored by Cabot Cheese today and for the next 2 weeks. God bless Cabot Cheese. It's a great product and it supports New York family farms. It's a cheese cooperative, for those of you who did not know that. And so therefore, when you buy from Cabot, you are supporting local agriculture. Our guests in studio right now are Shahara and Jason from the taco truck.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks so much for coming in, you guys. This is great. So tell me, first of all, where is the taco truck usually parked?
The taco truck does service in Hoboken and Jersey City. We do.
Jason, can you bring your mic a little
closer?
Sure,
I can.
Yeah, that's
perfect. We do lunch service in Jersey City Monday through Thursday.
Uh-huh.
And then we do a dinner service Monday through Thursday as well in Hoboken, uptown. And then we also have our restaurant open in Hoboken.
So you just opened a restaurant, right?
We did. Yep, about like 4 months ago.
That's amazing. Most people go in the opposite direction. They start with a restaurant, downsize to a truck. You guys have taken that great leap of faith. So you must be making some really badass tacos. Let's hear about your tacos.
I think we make some very badass tacos. We got a great culinary team together.
Uh-huh.
Our culinary partners, Roberto Santibanez, formerly of Rosa Mexicana.
Oh, I know him.
And
yeah.
He has Fonda here in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
Ah.
So he's one of our partners. We also have another great CIA graduate, Paris Ratana. He's a native of Mexico City as well. So we got a great team in there. Really putting out some authentic Mexican street food. People
that
love it.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah. There's a great taco truck in my neighborhood on the Upper West Side, which I patronize on the weekends mm-hmm. quite religiously. And one of the things I most admire about them are their salsas. They make really fabulous salsas and also pretty good tamales, although mm-hmm. not the best I've ever had.
We've got tamales.
You guys are making tamales?
Yeah, four great salsas we make daily. Habanero, chipotle, our fresh green, and our roasted red.
Beautiful.
People love it.
What's your best-selling product?
Probably our carnitas tacos.
Uh-huh, and that's pork?
It is pork, yep. Yeah. It's a slow-braised pork shoulder with a little bit of orange. We use a little bit of condensed milk in there as well.
No kidding, so it's a little creamy, sweet.
Yep.
Yum.
So we braise that, finish it on the flat top. It comes out in two soft shell corn tortillas with onion, cilantro, and your choice of salsa.
My mouth is watering. I'm starving. That sounds so good.
It is.
And you guys are sourcing from Nyman Ranch. So you're sort of like the Chipotle. I mean, if you'll forgive me mm-hmm. for doing the fast food analogy here,
sure.
but tacos are a fast food,
mm-hmm.
Probably the original fast food in many ways, besides the hot dog. So, and you guys are doing sort of the Chipotle thing. You're buying from very good quality producers like Nyman Ranch, Bell mm-hmm. and Evans. Who are some of the other people you mentioned?
Leedy's as well for all of our pork.
I don't know that.
Yep, they're in Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
So that's who we get all of our pork from. Again, all natural, no hormones, no antibiotics. Right. It's a great product.
And let's talk about the economics of that, just mm-hmm. because you're buying, you know, higher quality
sure.
ingredients. How are you able to pass that cost down to the consumer without having them freak out? Or are you still keeping your price point down?
We're still, you know, obviously we got to be at a certain price point so we can stay in business.
Mm-hmm.
We're not the cheapest taco on the block.
How much is a carnita taco?
You get two per order. It's $4.50.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Two and a quarter.
Yeah.
I'm down with that.
Yeah.
That's a real meal for $5.
And absolutely, you know, when with the quality ingredients that we're, you know, providing in our food, really you'd be the only other opportunity to have those really fresh, authentic Mexican flavors with that quality of product would be at a fine dining sit-down restaurant.
That's right.
So we're
like
excited.
Rosa Mexicana.
Exactly. So we're excited to be able to, you know, offer that product to the masses. So there's definitely some resistance on the pricing, but we really find through education and letting our customers know, you know, that they're getting a superior product that is made, you know, from scratch daily with care.
Made to order.
People start to figure it out.
Now, when you went from the truck, like when you were supplying the truck, did you cook in the truck? Where did you cook?
We had a commissary kitchen that we rented.
Uh-huh.
Very limited space. We were anxious to find the right space for the restaurant.
So you started out with the idea that you were going to create a brand with your truck.
Exactly.
Very smart business
model. The truck was really, you know, teaser. Yeah, we love being on the street with the truck. It's mobile marketing.
Yeah.
Great way to get our name out, build a fan base, really proof of concept, test our recipes. And it's been great transition.
Are you both from the restaurant industry? Do you have a background in that?
Actually.
Mm. How did you get into it?
I used to work in restaurants.
We're husband and wife, by the way.
Oh.
I used to work in the restaurant business, but, you know, in college, just waitressing tables and bartending.
Sure.
But I'm now on the marketing side.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And how about you, Jason?
No, not from the restaurant side. My family's been involved with restaurants, but not me personally. I'm a partner in a fly fishing company called Urban Angler in Manhattan. So that's sort of where my commitment to the sustainability comes from,
uh-huh.
just being, you know, involved in an outdoor activities
Absolutely.
Like fishing. I went to school in Vermont. So sort of took that entrepreneurial spirit with helping build Urban Angler into a national brand. We have another store in Virginia now. Decided, you know, I'm ready to do something else. It was either going to be going to business school or starting another business. So I decided to start another business.
So you guys came up with this idea of doing the truck as kind of a way to test out all your concepts and get the marketing going. And then found the took your time and found the ideal space. I'm loving this. Yeah. This is so smart.
Yeah.
I mean, really. Because most people, you know, oh, I want to start a restaurant, you know, and they have no opportunity to do any of that groundwork, which is really the essential component to making a successful venture.
Yeah, we had the right, when we opened the doors of the restaurant, you know, the recipes were proven.
Yes.
We had the right staff in place.
You had your economics under control. You knew what your costs were going to be.
Exactly.
Yeah. And really we had a groundswell of people that already loved the food and loved us. So they were like waiting, you know, the day that we opened at the door. So it was really exciting.
Now, how did you let them know? Had you created like a Twitter or a Facebook page?
Yeah, we've been building a community on Facebook and Twitter and on YouTube, and also just promoting it through our own channel. So just really embraced our loyal fans and had them kind of become our ambassadors and spread the taco love. But it really worked. I mean, we started out with 5,000 fans, you know, and followers, and it's quickly grown. So
that is fantastic. Yeah. I love
the power
this.
Of social media.
So now, where is your, let's give the address of your restaurant. Yep. And then is the restaurant named Taco Truck
it
also?
It is. It's the Taco Truck as well. It's 62 Newark Street in Hoboken, about 2 blocks from the PATH train. So for everyone that's never been to Hoboken in Manhattan or Brooklyn, it's an easy trip and definitely worth coming across the river.
For that pig that you just described. I'm salivating. It's so
delicious.
Lovely.
Yeah.
And the taco truck is going to continue to operate. How does the season affect you in terms of the taco truck? I mean, like, I don't mind eating outside in the nice weather, but, you know, wintertime.
It gets cold.
Yeah. Well, last season, since we only had the truck, we ran, you know, in the snow, digging out spots for the truck. We were out every day, you know, rain, snow, or shine. This year, we're going to rethink that a little bit.
Yeah.
I think we'll probably take the truck off the road for 2 months for sort of regular service, and then still have it be available for private events, parties, things like that. But yeah, probably the months of January and February, we'll take the truck off the road.
That makes sense to me. Yeah, absolutely. Although I could see like parking it in a, like where an office, you know, in an office location.
Yeah.
Like a downtown, like.
Well, it's definitely one of the more difficult things for us is, you know, we decided, well, besides the fact that we want to serve the community that we live in, we chose Hoboken because it's very difficult to get a permit in the city. It's a 3-year waiting list.
Wow.
And you're not even guaranteed a permit after waiting 3 years. So we knew we could get into the Hoboken and Jersey City market right away. The problem is it's just a smaller market, not as many people. So there aren't as many choices for places that we can park and do the sort of volume that we'd like to do. We also have a hard time in Jersey City getting chased away. The ordinances, we sort of operate in a gray area. So we've been trying to develop a pilot program where all the food trucks, there are a lot of food trucks in Jersey City as well now. Sort of that trend moved across the river. We got some, you know, great operators to try to get us set up in an empty space to sort of a food court.
Location.
Exactly, where people can come and find us. We're not parked on the street. We're not regulated by the city ordinances. If we're on private property, we can really do whatever we want. So,
how interesting.
We're hoping to make
I was wondering about that being chased off the corner thing, because in New York, you know, you read a lot about sort of the turf wars of trucks, and it is difficult, especially if there's a truck or some sort of a cart that's been there for a while, and, you know, some interloper comes in and...
Yeah, we found
I've heard some really serious, like, tires slashed, you know, vandalism.
Yeah. We had some interesting
things. We've been threats.
It's some interesting things happened when we first got the truck out. But we resolved that, and everyone's on the same page, and we're all sort of facing the same problems now, so we decided to put our differences aside and really
form
work to find a solution.
Oh, that's so it's become a political thing, and you're trying to leverage that into policy change at the government level.
Yeah.
That's very cool. Mm-hmm.
Jay makes frequent trips to the city hall to meet with the politicians just to get on the same page.
Well, this past summer when I was working with the New York City Food Film Festival, just before we had our food truck drive-in, which was about 40 food trucks, there was a city councilwoman who decided that she wanted to push through a resolution banning food trucks from the New York City streets. Mm-hmm. And it was only through direct intervention on the part of the mayor that was sidelined. And, you know, but it was like all these operators were just like freaking. I mean, that would have been the end of their livelihood. Some of them sunk their life savings into these trucks, you know, and were making a living at it. Mm-hmm. And with the economy being what it was, it's not like you can just, you know, turn
pick
on a dime. And,
Well, the New York vendors are, they've got a great advocacy group called the Street Vendor Project, which does great work to, you know, help these vendors when they get tickets, when they need legal representation in court, and they've decided to take on the Jersey City issue as well. So they've been a great advocate for us, and we appreciate everything that they're
doing.
That's
wonderful. Yeah. Well, you guys, I think we have to wrap it up here, but thanks so much for coming in, Shahara and Jason at the Taco Truck.
Thanks.
Good
for
luck with
us.
The restaurant. It sounds like it's probably already just a done deal. Are you planning on getting more trucks or opening new restaurants?
We're looking at opening more restaurants right
now. No kidding. So, you're going to do a whole
We hope
empire.
So.
Take over the world.
would you consider doing another truck in other cities? You have two trucks now, right?
We have one truck right now. It splits the service. Yeah, we're definitely would consider adding additional trucks in the right markets.
And you'd go to other cities to do that?
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow, I think this is just really exciting. Please check in with us on a regular basis.
We're looking for tips, too, for our next location. So if you have any good ideas as to where we should go.
Email us.
Let us know what neighborhood needs your tacos.
Really? The Upper West Side.
Yeah. Well, yes.
Outside of Manhattan.
Yeah, too bad. Yeah, right?
In Jersey.
Well, this has been great, you guys. Thanks so much for coming in. And, keep us posted. I'd love to have you back and talk more about what's happening with the taco trucks and just with truck vending and, food on the street, that kind of stuff. There's lots to talk about there.
Yeah, well,
we'd love to. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. I think next up we have Steve Pope, right, Jack? Nope, not this week, but maybe next. And so this is it from the main course on Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next week, it sounds like. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Martha, don't you moan, 'cause Pharaoh's on me. Don't you know that I've been dry?